Well, a few weeks ago, Dave Birch began his sermon by asking folks to name their favorite Old Testament character. And all I had was the recording of that sermon. Couldn't really hear all the responses from the congregation. But I did pick up that Danny answered with God. That was his favorite Old Testament character, which is not exactly what Dave Birch was looking for. But Dave went on and used it as an opportunity to talk about his favorite. How many remember the sermon it was on?
David.
On King David. Okay. Well, today is Reformation Sunday, and so I thought I would start off the same way. Who is your favorite reformer of the 16th century? So, Denny, go ahead and get it out of your system. All right. Today we're going to talk about God. Of course, everyone knows and admires Martin Luther, so that would be a given. But beyond him, does anyone else stand out that you have especially appreciated? Anyone want to offer some names? Calvin, okay. I knew his, who? Melanchthon? Zwingli? Okay, Urich Zwingli? How many of the reformers do you know? All right. Who?
John Knox.
Okay. I'm actually going to kill you afterwards. All right. I'm going to enter into the spirit of John Knox right now. All right. As you know, I don't know whether to laugh or just really get angry. I'm trying to decide. I was counting on no one choosing John Knox, but Nate proofreads the slides and knows that I'm talking about John Knox today. And I had told him not to tell anybody what we're talking about because I wanted to set it up. So I'm going to go sit down, turn off my microphone. We're going to do Dave Birch's prayer again. Then I'm going to come up and start all over. And when I ask the question again, I want you to be quiet. All right. All right, well, we have two holidays on the church calendar. I'm way off my notes now. We have two holidays on the church calendar this time of the year, back to back, Reformation Day and All Saints Day, which would be tomorrow. These do provide good opportunities for church history lessons, and so it's my intent to follow the tradition I put in place last year of setting aside a Sunday each year at this time to discuss something from church history. And last year we looked at who remembers who we looked at last year? Very good. Fourth century church father. And today we're going to jump forward 12 centuries to the Reformation and talk about John Knox. Someone that you have probably heard of, but I guess I would guess that you don't know a lot about him. And I would be reluctant to say that he is my favorite. He could be, I'm not sure, but he is certainly one that I would consider to be probably the most colorful and interesting. There is much about him to appreciate and admire. But on the other hand, admittedly, there are some things about him that are a little unsettling. But his contribution to the Reformation, especially in Scotland, where he led it, has made a noteworthy mark on church history. And it would serve us all well to know something about all of this. And he did earn the nickname the Thundering Scot. And he was a fiery preacher. And so today we're going to look at him. Is it showing anything behind me? Is this not? Okay, good. All right. All right. Now, before we dive into the life and times of John Knox, let me begin by just kind of laying the cards out a little bit, so to speak, so that you can get kind of a feel of the sort of man that he was. It is safe to say that he could be a little bit arrogant, proud, certainly stubborn, and he did have a reputation of being cantankerous, somewhat impulsive. He was not, by any stretch of the imagination, a gentle or sensitive kind of guy. He was strong-minded, sometimes even harsh. Just to give you one example, he published a book that in its title called The Queen of England at that time, a person that everyone is to honor and venerate with great respect. He called her a freak of nature. All right. Now, he just didn't say it. He published it, which is a big deal. And in fact, it was the title of the booklet. So he did not have a reputation for going out of his way to be charming or endearing. Even at his funeral, and being as diplomatic as possible, it was said of him when standing over his grave, "Here lies a man that neither flattered nor feared any flesh." And those words certainly sum up the character and life of John Knox. He certainly didn't flatter anyone, and he certainly didn't fear anyone. He was a kind of a, just a hardcore kind of guy. In fact, he thought the other reformers were all a bunch of wimps, sissies, when it came down to conflicts with the government. And he wanted to take the effort of the Reformation to a whole new level, something we'll talk about a little bit later. But again, there's much, much about John Knox to admire. He was tenacious, courageous, bold, because he was compelled by deep convictions for God's truth and a deep love for God himself. So this morning, as I offer a brief survey of his life, let me encourage you, as I have in the past, when we do church history, to just sit back and relax. Don't worry about taking notes. I'm going to cover a lot of information fast, and what I'll be sharing is readily available from a number of sources. So just consider this to be kind of a story time. These Sundays are a little different in the sense that we aren't exactly exegeting Scripture, but as you will see, there will be no shortage of biblical principles that will come into play. And because the story can be a little challenging to follow at times, I will use the slides to help with this. So, with that in mind, let's begin by briefly setting up the background here. The setting of Scotland in the early 1500s. Everyone know where Scotland is? Where's Scotland? Rebecca, if you were to show us on a map, how would you point to Scotland? Again, I don't know whether to laugh or get angry. I'm trying to decide this moment. It's directly north of England. Okay, it's on the same island. Everyone can picture this? We might need to do some geography here this morning. All right. So we need to set up the setting here of Scotland in the early 1500s. And it's somewhat complicated relationships with France, which was a Catholic country, and England, directly to its south, which sometimes was Catholic and sometimes was Protestant, depending on who was ruling at the time. In the 16th century, subjects of most of the European countries were actually required to adopt the religion of the rulers. And so there was often this back and forth struggle between Roman Catholicism and Protestantism. And those serving as rulers, kings or queens, would often be a Catholic or be a Protestant, not necessarily because of any deep convictions on their part, sometimes, but not usually, but because of politics. It would be politically advantageous to secure the support of another country, but to do so meant conforming to their policies and their religion. For instance, Scotland needed the support of France, needed it as an ally to help protect it from England, who often invaded its borders. England believed that Scotland belonged to them, and Scotland wanted to be independent, and therefore it had a history of adopting a pro-Catholic policy, even to the point of ordering the persecution of Protestants, this to appease France. And it seems that virtually all the European countries were pushing and pulling on each other to form allies in order to bolster their military strength. And one of the most common means of forming these allies would be through marriage. The Queen of England, for instance, would consider marrying the King of Spain's son or whatever. And with that came the person's religion, which would become the religion of the land. Again, it's kind of complicated, kind of messy, always in flux, always volatile, lots of conspiring, lots of wars, and the whole Catholic-Protestant conflict served as yet a major factor in all of this. All right, how many have seen, by chance, how many have seen the movie Elizabeth, starring Kate Blanchett, that came out just a few years ago? All right, good. Actually, several folks. All right. Now, you know you're not supposed to watch movies in this church, so we'll have to talk about that, but... What? They watch it outside. That's funny, actually. All right. That movie deals with this very issue in the very time period that we're talking about today. Not about John Knox, but it's talking about the time period of John Knox and about this whole issue, these complicated relationships in these countries with Europe. The story centers on Queen Elizabeth. of England, and you see all these dynamics coming into play, and actually provides a helpful picture, a context for appreciating many of the struggles of those who sought to advance Protestantism, what they faced, especially in England and Scotland. All right, by the time we get into the mid-1500s, this commitment to Scotland, this commitment that Scotland had to France, and therefore its commitment to Roman Catholicism, was starting to weaken somewhat. And there are several reasons for this. First, the teachings of Martin Luther and other reformers started to make their way through the country. And these teachings actually found fertile ground because of the influence of John Huss and others who many years earlier had challenged the practices and doctrines of the Catholic Church. And it had been impossible to uproot those ideas and teachings. On top of this, the distinguished upper class, the nobles, grew resentful of the growing power of the crown and were upset by the loss of many of their ancient privileges. And with this resentment came a resentment toward not only the queen, but also Catholicism itself, and even toward France for giving the queen so much power. In fact, France would often sometimes rule Scotland through one of its regents. And a good number of these nobles believed that England would have been a better ally than France, and not always England was generally more tolerant of the Protestant position. And then, this one's really interesting, there were the university students, who in any culture tend to be the radicals of the age. And there was in Scotland at this time a growing movement to smuggle in and circulate books of the Protestant authors. And it was just a cool thing to do, probably because it was illegal. But a lot of this was going on the campuses. And, you know, in my day, rebelling against authority meant growing long hair and smoking dope and protesting the war in Vietnam. Back then, it was reading and passing around John Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion, you know. So this is really interesting. And so even though the country was predominantly Catholic, there was this growing openness and interest to the teachings and practices of Protestantism. With that background in mind, let's now turn to John Knox. When Martin Luther posted his challenge to the practice of indulgences on the Wittenberg door in 1517, John Knox was just 2 or 3 years old at the time. Knox grew up in a small town, ordinary family, humble means. At about 15 or 16 years old, he entered the University of St. Andrews to study theology and was ordained a Catholic priest a few years later. He was ordained a Catholic priest. Dramatic events were unfolding in Scotland during the time of his youth. The first Protestant martyr was executed, which did not set well with the people, including Knox. As noted earlier, many of the writings of the reformers, Luther, Calvin, and others were being smuggled into the country, and authorities were unable to stop this. And these writings were read and studied in secret Bible studies sprouting up all over Scotland. Also, the power of Scotland changed hands during this time and fell upon Queen Mary of Scots, an infant. Her regent initiated a pro-English and pro-Protestant policy, and things like Bible reading was actually encouraged now. And he promoted the preaching of the reformers, and he even appointed a couple converted monks to be his chaplains. And they immediately went out, engaged in a preaching campaign across central Scotland. Knox was exposed to this, and their teachings had a dramatic influence upon him, and indeed it made a Protestant of him. However, a few years later, the authorities, you know, because there's all this stuff is always in flux, they turned 180 degrees, abandoned the Reformation policies. There was a change of power, and even threatened Protestants with persecution. One leading Protestant preacher this time was George Wishart. He refused to cave in and continued to courageously proclaim his convictions, traveling around the country. Impressed with what he heard about Wishart, Knox joined him and even served as his bodyguard, arming himself with a huge two-handed sword. Huge thing. In modern terms, think AK-47 assault rifle. That'd be the sort of effect that it would have. And this kind of gives you a preview, a snapshot of what Knox thought about armed force, subject coming up later. All right, after a few months, it became obvious that the authorities would be arresting Wishart, and he convinced Knox to spare himself and let him face his accusers alone. After all, he could not fight off the whole Scottish army with his two-handed sword by himself. So Wishart is arrested and found guilty of heresy, strangled, burned at the stake in a public execution, and this proved to arouse the fury of his supporters, who immediately set out to avenge his death, targeting the Catholic cardinal who ordered his arrest and execution, a man named David Baton. 16 nobles assassinated him, hung his body out of a castle window for everyone to see, and at least one of his attackers, in showing his utter contempt for him and his Catholic policies, urinated in his mouth. So this was definitely a reaction. Knox, his body was desecrated, obviously. Knox was not a part of the plan, didn't even know about it until afterwards, but he nonetheless wholeheartedly approved of it when asked about it. He justified his approval upon the principle that God often allows evil men to mediate punishment. That was his response. Knox throws himself into the crusade carrying the torch. He became an outspoken critic of Catholic doctrines and went around promoting the teachings of the reformers, especially salvation by faith, not works. His preaching style was very fervent. It often resulted in getting people really fired up. He was motivational in that way, and as a result, he became very popular. And indeed, he was on a mission and was quite determined and fearless in it. For instance, during this time, he went to a Catholic service where the doctrines of the Catholic Church were being defended on that particular morning, and the priest was basing his arguments on the claim that the Catholic Church was the bride of Christ and everything else was heretical. And Knox just stood up, interrupted the service, and shouted out that the Catholic Church was not the bride of Christ, but a harlot. Yelled it out right in the middle of the service. People in the church tried to shout him down, but in so doing, amazingly, the result ended up in being an opportunity for Knox to come back the next Sunday and defend his position, his accusation, which he did. Of course, he was now a target, featured every Saturday night on Scotland's Most Wanted TV show with John Walsh. And he had to kind of keep on the move to keep from being captured. But in all of his preaching and interrupting church services and so on, all these things obviously increased his visibility. He was soon arrested and was sent to the galleys. And these, of course, would be sailing ships that would be powered by oars. The conditions were... the conditions were miserable, even inhumane, extremely hard work. On top of this, we have reports of prisoners being vigorously pressured to renounce their Protestantism. There's a lot of interesting stories about all this and the reaction the prisoners had to that pressure. We don't have time for them this morning, but kind of some very, you know, fun stuff to talk about. But we'll skip it. Eventually, the English government took a keen interest in the plight of the prisoners and exerted pressure on Scotland to release John Knox, which they did. He spent the next 5 years in England as an honored guest. And the religious and political authorities of England were eager, actually, to advance the Reformation in England, had heard about the work of George Wishart and his work with George Wishart and Knox's known preaching abilities and wanted to take advantage of all that. And so Knox gave himself wholeheartedly to the effort and gained a great deal of popularity there in England as well. And he was granted opportunities to pastor a number of major and influential churches, very distinguished. But he turned them all down. Reasons are a bit unclear, but he was afforded numerous opportunities to preach and he took them. Once again, political developments interrupted things. In 1553, King Edward VI of England died, and his successor, remember this name, Queen Mary Tudor, took the throne. At first, she gave the impression that Protestantism would be tolerated, but it soon became clear that her real ambition was to reinstate the Catholic faith as the national religion in England, and she ordered the arrest and execution of all Protestant leaders, not just the arrest, but also the execution. Knox reasoned, rightly so, that the invitation which brought him into England in the first place was no longer in effect. And he headed to Geneva, Switzerland, where he met John Calvin. John K. He may have met Zwingli, but we do know that he met often with John Calvin. And for a while, he helped serve as a pastor there in Geneva. Back in Scotland, Protestants had redoubled their efforts. Small clandestine congregations were forming in all the major cities. At first, there was this more like kind of like the underground church movement in China, if you can kind of picture that. But eventually it became a little bit more open, a little bit more public. A lot more of them were springing up. And Knox returned to Scotland to help inspire the efforts there. The Catholic bishops, of course, alarmed by his popularity and influence, summoned him to face legal proceedings. The charges against him, interestingly enough, were dropped, but just this continued resistance against him by both political and religious leaders forced him to return again to Geneva. And it was there, from there, that he published his most controversial works. And at this point, because it's going to be these works are very interesting, but before we get into them, let me just set it up by saying at this point, you need to appreciate that this man is very frustrated, very discouraged, and actually has become pretty resentful and bitter. He has endured persecution, exile, the galleys, continued frustration with various queens, and on top of this list of those he most despises is this Queen Mary Tudor of England, a very powerful woman aggressively forcing her Catholicism in England and Scotland. And so he takes out his pen and outlines a position and publishes it in a pamphlet called The First Blast of the Trumpet Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women. what a title. The First Blast, you know, implies there's more to come. But get a taste of this. Monstrous regiment, meaning unnatural government. All right. In essence, he was arguing that the queen was a freak of nature. It was aimed directly at Mary Tudor, the one who had ordered the arrest and execution of Protestant leaders. If you watched the movie Elizabeth, Queen Mary is the one at the beginning of the movie who despises the fact that Elizabeth will take her place after she dies. And this is because Elizabeth was sympathetic toward the efforts of the reformers. In fact, she tries very hard to find some reason to justify having Elizabeth executed, but can't find anything. And in the movie, you see Protestants burning at the stake, because she orders for that. She really is a powerful, mean, heartless woman who hates Protestants. And in his pamphlet, he calls upon her to be removed from her throne. And he states two reasons. First, any monarch who promotes Catholicism is an idolater. And when such a leader forces idolatry upon its subjects, he or she is clearly outside the will of God. It is not natural, that is, in line with God's order, for a country's leader to promote sin. And in a second pamphlet, he builds his case on why Roman Catholicism promoted idolatry. Secondly, it is against God's natural law for a woman to rule. In that culture, they could not hold any public office whatsoever. But yet, people allowed them to rule supremely as queens. And Knox found this disturbing. It's contradictory. It's inconsistent. And he argued that it was in violation to God's natural order. He argued that women are weak. They do not have the stomach to make hard decisions, as in war. That their counsel tends to be foolish because it's based on emotion, not logic. And that their judgment is, quote, frenzy. And the pamphlet was very controversial all across Europe because other countries were also ruled by queens. In the third pamphlet, called Godly Letter, he takes it to the next level. And this one becomes 10 times more controversial. In it, he argued that if the people have the means to remove a Catholic queen by force, they are obligated to do so. If they don't, the people of the land share in the guilt of the sins committed by the queen. And this idea was radical for its time because, in essence, it promoted armed revolution against the ruler of the land, treason, and all in the name of Christ. But to John Knox, the argument was airtight. She is a rebel against God for many reasons, and if the people can do something about it, and if they don't, then the blood is on their hands. That was his argument. And up to this time, the reformers had more or less encouraged what we would call passive resistance or passive civil disobedience. For instance, if a monarch ordered you to become a Catholic or worship as a Catholic, you were not obligated to obey. This is part of that higher laws ethic that we have talked about here in the past. But John Knox took this to a whole new level, escalated it. He argued against passive resistance and called upon Christians to actually conspire together with those in upper levels of the government to overthrow Queen Mary, whom he called, quote, the wicked English Jezebel, and if necessary, overthrow her by force. However, he was pretty much alone on this. John Calvin was very much opposed to his teachings on this and would not allow the circulation of any of his pamphlets in Geneva. Knox found no support from the other reformers either, and they just simply were not convinced that treason and armed revolt in the name of Christ could be justified biblically. And indeed, no physical revolt ever occurred. But by and large, people who read his pamphlets were no doubt sobered by the arguments he made, and even if many did consider him to be a dangerous radical at this point. And it all certainly contributed to this aggressive, passionate effort to inspire everyone to work diligently for the reformation of both England and Scotland. Politically, his pamphlets proved to be a major setback for him in more ways than one. Mary Tudor's half-sister Elizabeth, again, if you saw the movie, you can make the connection here, becomes queen. And even though she would have been a great ally to Knox, she was so appalled by his pamphlets that she wanted nothing to do with him. In fact, the words "she hated him" are used in history books. And this is unfortunate because they both could have benefited from each other in many ways, but Knox had poisoned the well. And it cost him in other relationships as well, including a number of friends and fellow comrades in the movement. Knowing this, Knox said, "My first blast has blown me from all my friends in England." All right, now back to Scotland, where things are moving toward a crisis. Knox left Geneva for the last time and returned to Scotland in the spring of 1559, serving as ruler now of Scotland was another Mary, known as Mary of Guise, who would be a regent from France. And there was great tension in the land between her power to rule and promote her Catholic ways and the increasing influence and popularity of Protestantism. John Knox, of course, was warmly welcomed by the Protestants, took advantage of his popularity, thus authority, to inspire a Protestant militancy, if you will. For instance, within days of his arrival, Knox preached a fiery sermon, fierce and eloquent, against Catholic idolatry. He got everyone so worked up that after the service, a riot actually broke out. People stormed into Catholic churches and demolished their altars and smashed their images and so on. And this kind of gives you an idea of this persuasive power Knox had in his sermons, thus the name the Thundering Scot. He went all over Scotland encouraging Christians to repent from their apathy and help in the fight for the Reformation of Scotland. However, what he really needed was for the French to get out of Scotland and to take Mary of Guise with them. As long as they were in control, the efforts to reform Scotland would be severely hampered and just practically impossible. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, a group of nobles who favored the Reformation, known as the Lords of the Congregation, conspired with the English to draft out a treaty. And the threat of war from the English resulted in the French leaving Scottish soil. And without French intervention, the future of the Reformation in Scotland was now pretty much assured. Later that month, the Scottish Parliament met, and Knox was invited to preach to his most distinguished audience ever at a Thanksgiving service. The Parliament ordered Knox and five of his colleagues to write a confession of faith, which was quickly adopted. They then passed acts to abolish the Catholic Mass, repudiate papal jurisdiction, and rescind laws that were in conflict with the Reformed faith. However, challenges remained. Parliament passing a few laws doesn't always change everything overnight. There continued to be in Scotland two churches, Roman Catholic and Reformed, and much work remained to be done to establish an efficient government in the Protestant church, and it needed to be properly organized and financially supported because there certainly wouldn't be any big dollars coming in from the Vatican to help. Knox continued to play an active role in all these developments. In fact, the form of Presbyterian government that we find in many churches today, including our own, can be traced back to the contribution of John Knox and his determination to restore that New Testament model. Now, at this point, we would expect that the final years of his life to be, you know, pretty easy, because it seemed like the battle is now behind him. But not so. The daughter of Mary of Guise, known as the Mary of Scots, came to rule over Scotland and was a devout Catholic, now ruling a Protestant country. And she was powerful and mean and hated Protestants and so on. And under her, Scotland suffered great turmoil, almost bringing the whole country to collapse. But kind of jumping on here, by the early 1570s, the hard years of fighting for the Reformation of Scotland were definitely taking their toll on Knox. In his remaining years, it was reported that he became an embittered man, despising, probably even hating, and probably hating intensely the Queen. That would be a safe assumption to make. Though his health was deteriorating, he insisted on preaching, even when his voice became so weak that even those standing next to him could hardly hear him. And on November 9th, 1572, he died, placing him roughly my age, 57, maybe 58 years old. The Reformation in Scotland would continue to establish itself over the coming decades, three steps forward, two steps backwards kind of a thing. But it did get its footing in the single-minded devotion and burning sincerity of John Knox, the Thundering Scot. All right, now, before I talk about a couple of the relevant lessons for us, let me just offer a few assorted and interesting facts that kind of go along with the story, but didn't know quite where to fit them in. In the early 1500s, this is really amazing to me. I just found this difficult to comprehend. In the 1500s, the Catholic Church owned more than half the real estate of Scotland and gathered an annual income of almost 18 times that of the crown. Amazing. Another thing, bishops and priests were usually appointed because of their political connections, not because they were biblically qualified. I think most of us are aware of that in that time period. For instance, this Cardinal Baton that I talked about earlier, who ordered the execution of Charles Wishart and was publicly disgraced after he died, he had many concubines. Everybody knew about this. It was very open, and he had fathered several children with them. And on another interesting note, in contrast to that, the Scottish reformers were actually quite strict, very legalistic. Celebration of Christmas was forbidden. Only the Lord's Day could be observed. No other holidays. Beginning in 1598, and this would be well after the death of John Knox, fines were imposed on those who missed worship services. And there were two services every Sunday. They were mandatory. Imagine being, you know, having to pay like a parking ticket. These would be a fine. We have a report of five men being jailed for 3 hours for skipping a Sunday morning service. Now, I'm kind of getting some ideas here. I like this one. This is something they did, too. Guards would be posted at the church doors to keep people from leaving before the benediction was given. Hallelujah. I'm all for that. Let's start. Now, all this might seem a little harsh to us, but to the reformers of that day, try to put yourself here in this context, it was an all-or-nothing proposition. Nothing less than the reform of every Scot was their goal. And by golly, we're going to do it. You mean that was kind of the attitude. Another interesting fact, in his sermons, Knox typically spent half an hour calmly exegeting a biblical passage. And then, as he applied the text to his Scottish audience, he would become so worked up, the history books say active and vigorous, pounding the pulpit and shouting, that he would make everyone in their seats tremble and quake. You know, really, a little bit like me, I think, perhaps. Another fact, Queen Mary once pleaded with Knox to keep Protestants from taking up the sword against the Catholic priests. To this, Knox replied, "The sword of justice is God's, and if princes and rulers fail to use it, others may." And then finally this one, this is a little bit sad. Until this century, when a statue of Knox was erected in the capital city, there had been no memorial dedicated to him in Scotland. Even today, the spot where he is buried is covered over by a parking lot. It is. All right. So the question now becomes, besides this, the question now, as we consider this somewhat fascinating story, is what lessons can we learn from this thundering Scott? Well, several things come to mind. Many of them are pretty obvious, and I'm only going to mention just a couple here because of time, and I'm just kind of move through them briefly. But first of all, this would be his tenacity. He was quite resolved, determined, and committed, and really in a remarkable, unusual, astounding way, just to see this homeland of his freed from the tyranny of the Roman Catholic Church. He gave himself wholeheartedly to this, made it his life's mission, and in so doing, he faced intense persecution from both religious and civil authorities. And he was on the FBI's most wanted list all the time, considered an enemy of the Queen, and more than just one queen, I might add. But this courage and passion and zeal is something that Christians in modern days, we really do lack. For the most part, we have become apathetic and lazy and even despondent. We're all too willing to cave in if threatened with any kind of inconvenience, much less hard suffering for the faith. And a prime example of this, I could give thousands, but of course, with this being election week, would be the fact that Christians, like pagans, will, for the most part, on Tuesday, cast their vote for the candidate they will believe that will provide for them a more cushier lifestyle, rather than the candidate who will honor God's laws, as in protecting the sanctity of life and the sanctity of marriage. Just one of many examples. When I think of John Knox, I think of that passage in Hebrews 11, where the writer exhorts his listeners to have the same uncompromising resolve as those who, through faith, conquered kingdoms, administered justice, gained what was promised. Remember that passage? Shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, escaped the edge of the sword, destitute, persecuted, mistreated. The world was not, how's that end? The world was not worthy of them. Now, that's kind of what comes to mind. He fits into that. And I could easily see, the example of John Knox being included there. He flattered nor feared any flesh. Another thing that I believe is worth pointing out is his willingness to push things beyond the status quo. He wrestled with questions that many wouldn't even consider. Though I have some reluctance about accepting his conclusions, I actually admire his drive to think deeply about a Christian's obligation to remove a wicked ruler by force. And this sort of pushing and pulling on ethical questions is a good thing, and one, something that we would all do well to imitate on whatever that issue might be, to really think about and push on it. Another characteristic of Knox that we would all do well to imitate would be just simply his perseverance, similar to the first one, but make it separate. He really did stay in the fight. And this persistence is something I truly admire, especially when one considers just how many obstacles he faced. And this was his whole life. Now, it is, admittedly, a bit disheartening that he became battle-weary, which manifested in his hating the Queen and refusing to listen to his counselors, which he didn't do very well, and, even inspiring his audiences to get all militant. And that should serve as a warning for us. When enduring an extended conflict like this, there must be that drive to persevere, but also a drive to rest in God's grace and not get crushed emotionally by the hardships and setbacks. And it did take its emotional toil on him. And I can't excuse the resentment that John Knox sometimes had, but just to a small degree, I can identify with it a little bit. There were times when, in my years of leading pro-life activism here in the Fort Wayne area, that I wrestled with this. You get lawsuits and conflicts with civil authorities and opposition from area pastors and Christian leaders and, on and on and on. The battle, it drains your time, finances, energy, ambition, emotion, costs you friendships and freedom and so on. And I know you're going to find this a little hard to believe, but there were times when I got a little crusty around the edges with all this stuff and even irritable a couple times. And so I actually am willing to cut Knox a little slack because I truly do admire and appreciate his longevity in the battle to reform his homeland, Scotland. And I really do wish I had his perseverance. But again, in this perseverance that we should imitate, we should be equally diligent in whatever battle we are called to endure in, of not falling into the same trap that he did, of becoming sour and cynical. All right, now, originally, I had wanted to talk about Knox's position on all these controversial issues, women ruling as queens and, you know, the call to arms of overthrowing a godless monarch, even by force. In fact, that's one of the reasons I was looking forward to talking about John Knox. But to do so would mean that I would have to talk really fast, and we still wouldn't get out of here until early afternoon, even if I talked super fast. But these are subjects that I do plan to cover once we finish up our series on Ephesians, which we will resume next Sunday. In 2011, we're going to spend a lot of time on short topical subjects, and this will be included. These things will be included in that. So these three questions, taken from the three controversial pamphlets that Knox published, are ones that we're going to look at in the coming year. Do the scriptures allow a woman to rule over men in civil government? Can they serve as a queen, a president, a senator, a mayor, or whatever? Knox would say no. And do the scriptures allow for what is called forcible resistance toward godless leaders? That is, taking up arms and removing them by force. Knox would say yes. And does the Catholic Church promote idolatry? Again, Knox would say yes. And a related question, more crucial for us, would be, does the Catholic Church promote idolatry today? All right, so all these are relevant questions for us, and when we look at them again sometime in this coming year, after Ephesians, we will consider the arguments that Knox himself made about them. That'll be part of it. All right, upon that note, let's have the musicians come forward, and let's stand, and as you do, I'll leave us with these words from the author of Hebrews. Chapter 11, he writes, "And what more shall I say? I do not have time to tell you about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength and who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. Women received back their dead, raised to life again. Others were tortured and refused to be released so that they might gain a better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging while others still were chained and put in prison. They were stoned. They were sawed in two. They were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains and in caves and holes in the ground. These were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised. God had planned something better for us, so that only together with them would they be made perfect." Amen.